I'm thinking, like, how do you talk about Yeats? It's so clear and so just what it is.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, we're talking about Oh Joseph, I'm So Tired by Richard Yeats. It's considered to be one of the best stories by Richard Yeats, a man who perhaps didn't enjoy a lot of accolades when he was alive and publishing his work. One of the reasons this podcast even exists is precisely because of writers like Richard Yeates. Maybe most people would say, never heard of him, about Yeats and his novels and stories. That's become practically a cue for us to get going on talking about a largely unsung writer we hold in very high esteem. Oh, Joseph, I'm So Tired is an unusual title, but by that I mean it's glorious. And you have to read the story to know why I'm saying this. Or better yet, just listen to what Peter Orner has to say about it. And Peter talks about a lot of other things that make him adore this story. Richard Yeats was the mentor of Peter's mentor, André Debussy, so there's a strong kinship there already. Something Peter recognizes about Yeats is the way that he can align beauty with the minor tragedies of our lives, our childhoods. And that makes for a kind of nostalgia that borders on something kind of wondrous. Richard Rousseau wrote that the reason we're pulled to Yeats' story so quickly has to do with our understanding of what his characters so desperately desire. What often keeps us turning pages is the more gradual revelation of those same characters' anxieties. And it's not just simple resonance I'm talking about here. It's just that we see whole worlds mirrored there. We see them and we recognize them. The most primal of these, writes Rousseau, is loneliness, the fear of which causes the people in Yeats' stories to endure terrible humiliations. In our discussion, Peter refers to the story as something delightful, but it's so dark. Is delight incongruous with darkness? Oh no. The notion really lines up with what Richard Rousseau says about Yeats' stories too. The excitement one feels reading these dark stories, I believe, is the exhilaration of encountering, recognizing, and embracing the truth. It's not a pretty truth, too bad. That we recognize ourselves in the blindness, the neediness, the loneliness, even the cruelty of Yeats's people, will have to suffice. Well, for story lovers and lonely voices, it's more than enough. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Oh Joseph, I'm So Tired by Richard Yeats. Can you talk about this idea just briefly about it being so clear? Because you just described what I was thinking about Yeats.
I just think there's a way that he has of being direct and distilled in a way that just, you know, you just don't see. It's a much imitated and much attempted. But when Franklin D. Roosevelt was president-elect, there must have been sculptors all over America who wanted a chance to model his head from life. But my mother had connections. Like, it's just... that comma, but my mother had connections. It's just so, you know, you just know. I think even if you're coming to Yeats for the first time, you might hear the doom in that sentence. You know what I mean? Like that there's people all over America who want to sculpt his head, but my mother, she's the one, but somehow she's almost lumped in with the rest of them. You know, the connections, I think you can almost feel that they're not going to make a damn bit of difference, but maybe that's hindsight. There's so much that I guess is said about Yeats, you know, like he's the crown prince of failure writing, you know what I mean? And things like that. He sees us. He sees that we are, that we strive and we are more than our failures, but our failures are really, really important to us.
That first part that you just read, and you just know this idea that even though she has connections, that you just know that that's not necessarily going to turn out well. And then when we read the very next part, one of her closest friends and neighbors in the Greenwich Village courtyard where we lived was an amiable man named Howard Whitman, who had recently lost his job as a reporter on the New York Post. Even just that detail seals it, this idea that, oh, this isn't going to go very well. This is a very dubious thing that we're learning about the mother.
And it just gets progressively worse and worse as the story moves along. But it's also, I mean, it's a story of somebody not reaching their expectations, their dreams. But it's also a story of friendship and also a story of ordinary nastiness and long declines, the beginning of a long decline. I mean, it's just, I mean, we're making it sound depressing, but why is this story so delightful? Why is it so funny? Why is it so, I don't know, it made me feel lighter this morning, even though it is like devastating in its weight and its sort of calamity, really. One of the characters that I'm curious about and that isn't, you know, we don't know what happened. We don't know what happens to the narrator. We don't know what happens to the sister. But there's hints also, and never explored, but hints of even their lives are going to end up being, they're going to leave this courtyard and things are not going to be easy.
But this is the thing, too, about this story. So I was reading it the other day at my desk at work, and somebody walked by and said, "What are you reading? What's it about?" And I gave a, you know, I had a very hard time answering the question on the spot. And I was trying to keep it very brief. And then I thought, but this is where the story's magic is. I mean, this is why it is delightful, as you said, is it's because you really can't tell a story like this in one sentence. You really just can't summarize it and just say, oh, it's about this boy and his mother, blah, 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 and you're done. And this is how he tells the story. There are so many characters. There are so many situations and scenes. And even though you're so immersed in them and delighting in them, to use your word, and I love the writing, I just love the way he writes, there is a lot going on, and then it just comes to this pinpoint, and you can start to understand why there are so many characters, why there are so many situations, and why there are so many scenes. And it's not this weird pile on, like he didn't know what to delete or whatever. It just is this composite whole. And to move something out, I think would make it fall apart. It just works. I mean, it's just so genius.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, we should say we're 1933, Greenwich Village, and they're people without a lot of money, which already makes it very ancient history, right? Mm-hmm. And they're in this courtyard, and they're all divorced, and they're all raising kids, single parenting, single mothers, and fathers are, you know, in the city somewhere else, but not here, and it's, you know, people struggling, and they're in their 30s. And again, there's this idea of the expectations of their lives are going to, Sloan's going to write radio plays and get famous. She's a secretary on Wall Street. And the mother in the story is a Protestant Republican woman from Ohio, but she's also a Greenwich Village bohemian, which is funny and hilarious, and also at that time probably possible, right? That there was that kind of like diversity in income, and also kind of like where you were coming from in New York at that time. And here she is, she's a sculptor, and she's going to sculpt the president's head, the president-elect's head, President Franklin Roosevelt. And she, like we said, she's got connections. So she makes it to the headquarters in New York, and she measures the president's head. While she's doing that, she tells him, "Mr. President, I didn't vote for you. I'm a good Republican," which Yeats kind of talks about as being this kind of idea of like, you know, like good Ohio, like the sort of Republican, of course, doesn't exist anymore. It has been completely obliterated. But, you know, kind of an old school, you know, Gerald Ford kind of Republican. And she tells Roosevelt that. And Roosevelt is kind of like befuddled. And he's like, "Who is this lady?" And then she's out of there. She gets to Roosevelt, right? And then, as indicated by the narrator, she's not a good artist. So what she makes ends up being kind of a disaster. Unfortunately, like the trajectory of her life is going in a direction that she's desperately trying to stop, but can't. And I think Yeats knew about expectations, a lot about expectations.
When Billy describes her going to measure the president's head, and she says, "I'm a good Republican, I voted for Hoover. Why are you here?" Or something like that. And I said, "Because you have a very interesting head." So he gave me the smile again, and he said, "What's interesting about it?" And I said, "I like the bumps on it." And then, but the next part, she's being so honest. I mean, it seems like she's not, taking a jab at him. She's being so honest. But, and then it says, "By then she must have assumed that every reporter in the room was writing in his notebook while the photographers got their flashbulbs ready. Tomorrow's papers might easily read, 'Gal sculptor twits FDR about bumps on head.'" But that's not what's happening. That's not what's happening at all.
It's a very minor encounter, the sort that you can't quite imagine today, right?
I mean,
but, at that time, and not every second was covered, not everything was important, Roosevelt probably saw a lot of people who were incidental. And this is just some lady wants to make a sculpture out of my head. Fine, I'll give her a couple minutes. And he does. He does. There's a wonderful description of Roosevelt himself and his disability and, his braces and the kind of thing that was really hidden at that time. So, Helen gets a view of the president that, the people didn't. It's kind of an interesting moment. But, of course, that's not what she's interested in. She's interested in his head. And there is no coverage. There is no reporters taking notes. Nobody cares. Nobody cares.
Yes, and she has to tell them, this group in the studio, about what happened only after she has asked for a drink. So that's a very interesting and maybe important thing to mention. She says, "Will somebody get me a drink?" she asked, looking around in mock helplessness. "Then I'll tell you all about it." And so he's telling the story, and he's adding these details that we piece together. Oh, and this is after the whole scene with the father, too.
The father is absent, but is present in their lives. And there's a pretty gorgeous scene where dad drops them off after a visitation, and Yeats describes, and this is what he's so fearless about describing, whereas I think other writers might get into trouble here, right? Sentimental trouble. I think Yeats understands that sentimentality is very much a part of our life. And if we deny that it exists, I think that he's cutting us off from an emotion that sometimes is very real, I think. And those hugs of his, the climax of his visitation rites, were unforgettable. "One at a time, we would be swept up and pressed hard into the smells of linen and whiskey and tobacco. The warm rasp of his jaw would graze one cheek, and there would be a thick, moist kiss near the ear. Then he'd let us go." Obviously speaks for itself, but it's risky, and it gets harder, because when he walks away and he's almost out of the courtyard, they remember that he's got some stamps in his pocket that he promised to give them from his work at General Electric, where he's a regional sales manager. "Daddy, Daddy, you forgot the stamps." He stopped and turned around, and that was when we saw he was crying. He tried to hide it. He put his face nearly into his armpit, as if that might help him search his inside pocket, but there was no way to disguise the awful bloat and pucker of a face in tears. I mean, yeah. You could study that for hours, but that physical attempt to hide what he can't hide by putting his face nearly into his armpit, I think, is Yeats's way of not, it's not a cheesy scene. It could be.
And Billy says, "Here," he said, "here you go." And he gave us the least convincing smile I had ever seen. It would be good to report that we stayed and talked to him, that we hugged him again, but we were too embarrassed for that. We took the stamps and ran home without looking back.
Yeah.
That's so honest and real. And
it's also the restraint of it. I mean,
yeah.
He knows to leave it alone, as they did. Kids don't sit there in it, and I might think, tell myself or like my students, don't run away from a scene. Don't linger. It's a word I use way too much, because I find that people run away from scenes, you know, I do myself. But Yeats knows when to end a scene too, and this is, thank God he does, because it leaves you as bereft as the father who wanders in and out of the story. I mean, he's kind of a benign figure. He's shy, and he's sort of, you know, kind of just somebody on the edge of their life. And I mean, in other Yeats stories, his character might loom larger, and he does in some. But there's something kind of, beautiful about his presence in the story that sort of floats just past the margins of it, where the story really is about, you know, his mother, which is why we're doing the story for Mother's Day, right?
Yeah. So what about this mother?
What about this mother? She's very, she's flawed, and she's wonderful, and she's funny, and she's self-aware of her ridiculousness. You know, I think that's important. You know, I think she knows damn well she's not a great artist. She knows damn well that probably her vision of grandeur here with being the presidential sculptor may possibly not work out. I think she's gunning for it. She's hoping, but this is not somebody who isn't used to knocks. I mean, she's had a bunch of them. And, but at this point in her life, and I think that's the tragedy of the story or whatever. I mean, that sounds too dumb, cooked up, but I don't know, what's a minor tragedy of the story, right? I think is that at this point in her life, she was young enough to believe that she could overcome the failures, right? And then at a certain point, she turns a corner, and this is the sad message of all of Yeats's work is you turn that corner, and it's a long descent, and you know, and you could say there's just despair, but I think in the descent is like a lot of humor and a lot of like life there too that Yeats knows about, so I don't find it totally despairing, but God knows when you turn that corner, it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, but and that's so real too. I mean, about our parents, about parents, when we see that they're flawed, that they make terrible mistakes, that they say terrible things, that they do terrible things, and the story can continue. And that's another thing about all of the scenes and situations here with Sloan or with Bart or with Nicholson, with all of these characters, and we're learning about all of them and seeing from Billy's perspective what the adults in his life are all about, but also it is very much about the mother and her interactions with them and her place in this circle of friends, but also in her role as a mother. And I think that this idea about how she's a certain age where she still has hope that she's creating a life for herself. I think it's sort of unspoken in this story, but it's certainly implied. But the idea of the alcoholism it's present here. I mean, there are things that she does that cause her to. She herself is very responsible for the way things go sometimes. It's not really, you know, it's the depression era and life is happening to her. There's so much that she is responsible for, too. Even her behavior with FDR and the alcohol. All of these things are things that she is responsible for. And so I think that's another lesson for Billy and Edith is this idea that it's not just life happening to us as happens, but that she is making a lot of mistakes herself.
Yeah, as we all do. But I think that those mistakes don't define the character. And I think that's what makes this such a great story is that it isn't, you know, I think it's less about the mistakes than the life she built for them at this time.
Yes.
You know, this story is like a celebration of life in that courtyard, and in spite of the fact that it all goes to shit and this is just temporary, it feels like it's an attempt to just like hold on to that just little bit, even though the story's honest enough to say every sign was there that this wasn't gonna be a triumph. There's this beautiful scene where this neighbor, John, uses a bow and arrow. Well, it's not a beautiful scene. It's a horrifically cruel scene, but they've been buying goldfish at the Woolworths, which weirdly, I mean, maybe I'm just ancient at this point, but I mean, the Woolworths in my hometown still sold goldfish that we bought in little baggies and brought home. And it's weird. No, but anyway, John, this kid who's sort of like, he's moving, you know, he's moving up in the world. He's at boarding school, kind of a fancy day school in another town, which Helen, the narrator's mother, actually arranged for him to go to. So he comes home on weekends and he's kind of like a jock, and he's kind of like full of life. And anyway, he's showing off. And so he's talking about the ways that the goldfish move and how their speed and agility is like miraculous. And he wants to demonstrate their speed and agility by showing that they can evade his bow and arrow. And so he tries this funny, this horrible experiment, and it goes wrong. And he shoots the bow and arrow at the goldfish, and he kills the goldfish. And this is so shocking to the narrator that he runs to Billy, that he runs to his mother. And he says this: "I was too old to cry, but something had to be done about the shock and rage and grief that filled me as I ran from the fountain, heading blindly for home. And halfway there, I came upon my mother. She stood looking very clean, wearing a new coat and dress I'd never seen before, and fastened to the arm of Mr. Nicholson, her boyfriend at the time. They were either just going out or coming in, I didn't care which, and Mr. Nicholson frowned at me. He told me more than once that boys of my age went to boarding school in England, but I didn't care about that either. I bent my head into her waist and didn't stop crying until long after I felt her hand stroking my back, until after she'd assured me that the goldfish didn't cost much, and I'd have another one soon, and that John was very sorry for the thing he'd done. I discovered or rediscovered that crying is a pleasure, that it can be a pleasure beyond all reckoning if your head is pressed in your mother's waist and her hands are on your back, and if she happens to be wearing clean clothes." You know, I'll go a long way, way, way to read that paragraph, in spite of the fact that Helen has her more despicable moments, like when she's, you know, nakedly anti-Semitic at the end of the story. But it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me because she was there in that moment. And the narrator, after many years, apparently, is remembering that. And I think that, you know, Helen, you know, I call her a tragedy or a minor tragedy if she didn't triumph. But, you know, I think she triumphed there.
I agree. And I think also, I mean, it just shows the dimension that she has as their mother. And this is such an honest depiction of a mother. She's, you know, she's not 100% pure evil, horrible. You know, he can recall a moment like this where he's a young boy, this terrible thing has happened to the fish. It is shocking for him from his perspective. And she happens to be there. And his impression in recalling it is that she was clean. She was welcoming in that moment to try to console him. She didn't go along with Nicholson and say, "Oh, don't cry. You're too old to cry. It's just a fish." She allows him to cry. The writing there is so beautiful. I'm sort of on this line of, is it sentimental? Is it romantic? Is it nostalgic or not? I wanted to ask you about this. I go to this place where I keep saying, no, it's not. But why is it so gorgeous? Why is it so moving? Why is it so resonant? But I don't find it to be, I don't know, there has to be another word for it. I don't know. I don't understand what's happening with Yeats. And not just in this story, but in other stories too. Even something like where he's describing this: "That same summer, Mr. Nicholson gave me a 3-year subscription to Field and Stream, and I think that impenetrable magazine was the least appropriate of all his gifts because it kept coming in the mail for such a long, long time after everything else had changed for us. After we'd moved out of New York to Scarsdale, where Mr. Nicholson had found a house with a low rent, and after he had abandoned my mother in that house with no warning to return to England and to the wife from whom he'd never really been divorced. There's just this, he's just talking about this magazine, and I'm so moved by the way he remembers that that stupid subscription never ended and this magazine kept coming and reminding him. I don't know how he does it.
Long and, after, yes. Nicholson has disappeared from their life. You know, like you say, the magazine keeps coming, and it's almost like the perfect symbol, you know, of kind of a Yeatsian sort of like it goes on, it continues, and the memories pile up, and it isn't gone, you know, it's gone and not gone, it's still there, and that's I think a kind of an encapsulation of the story itself. He's carrying this around. He's carrying around this courtyard. You know, and a lot of times in Yeats, especially in the novels, it will move forward in time, and so you'll realize that here, and I'm especially partial to his short stories because I think there's this sort of like almost compression that implies the passage of time as opposed to expressing it directly, mm-hmm. And I think here you feel the weight of the fact that this is all past in that line. Of that the magazine keeps coming and coming, but there isn't the dramatization of the future expressly. And I think I think that's what's so kind of astounding about he's able to get that without saying it.
Well, two things that we have to mention, or two people we have to mention: Bart, the Dutch violinist, who's the tutor that she hires. So the children don't go to school; they're tutored by this young man, and also the Christmas Eve scene. I mean, there's so much to say to sort of come to a point where we can conclude the episode, but we have to get there.
Yeah, Bart is a great character. He's a violinist who's down on his luck, who Helen, in her kindness and her need, not only employs, but also, you know, because she needs somebody to tutor her kids because she won't send them to public school because that's sort of beneath her. But she can't afford private school, so she splits the difference and basically homeschools them, right?
Yeah.
And Bart is their tutor, and he's also, you know, kind of hungry, like literally hungry. So she feeds him and gives him every day a glass of Ovaltine, which she says to her other friend that might be his only nourishment for the day. And so he's a character who the kids like. A lot. And he plays with them. He swings them around and does airplane with them in the courtyard after they do their homework and studies. And he's a presence in their lives. And he's somebody who, upon whom the story kind of hinges at the end, surprisingly, you know, and maybe leave that for people to read themselves.
Yeah.
But it feels like to me like, you know, Bart's presence, he's a kind presence and they are kind to him. But, you know, that comes with the cost.
He's actually, for a while there, a very positive part of their lives. He is doing the job of tutoring them, and they like him. And he's very entertaining. I like the way Billy describes him playing the violin. And he's a very positive character up to a point. There's also Sloane's play that I wanted to mention that she's written. And he says, you know, she has all of these characters that are based on these people in Greenwich Village. There was more like that, introducing other characters. And toward the end, she got around to the children. She described my sister as a lanky, dreamy tomboy, which was odd. I had never thought of Edith that way. And she called me a sad-eyed 7-year-old philosopher, which was wholly baffling. When the introduction was over, she paused a few seconds for dramatic effect, then went into the opening episode of the series, or what I suppose would be called the pilot. I couldn't follow the story very well. It seemed to be mostly an excuse for bringing each character up to the microphone for a few lines apiece. And before long, I was listening only to see if there would be any lines for the character based on me. And there were, in a way. She announced my name, Billy. But then, instead of speaking, she put her mouth through a terrible series of contortions, accompanied by funny little bursts of sound. And by the time the words came out, I didn't care what they were. It was true that I stuttered badly. I wouldn't get over it for 5 or 6 more years, but I hadn't expected anyone to put it on the radio. You know, there's something here with this character of this woman who's the mom's friend and who's in their lives and who has written this story about them and has underscored this attribute of this boy, a sad-eyed seven-year-old philosopher. And he doesn't forget it. He doesn't forget it. In this telling, you know, he's an adult hearkening back to his childhood. He hasn't forgotten what she said, what she wrote, what she presented to them in this group, what she would have put on the radio if she could. And it comes back later in the story, this same point. And it's sort of entwined with the mother's story and what the mother does at the end of the story.
Yeats knew our cruelties, and he especially knew the cruelties of writers because he could be very cruel. And I think what's kind of remarkable to me about the use of the stuttering as a way of describing the narrator and how hurtful that is that the narrator doesn't totally destroy Sloane in this story. Sloane is the one who gets the title. Sloane's the one who tells the story at Christmas about Mary and her telling Joseph how tired she is as she's walking to Bethlehem to have the baby, right? And it's a gorgeous, and one of my favorite titles of all time, "Oh Joseph, I'm so tired." And it comes from Sloane, who's the same person who makes fun of the kid's stutter for a radio show that never is going to air because she's not that talented. It's not that he loves the cruelty. He needs to express it. It needs to be there.
Yeah.
In Helen and in Sloane and in other characters too. That again, it doesn't define them. In lesser hands, the cruelties would define the characters.
Right. I think as an adult, the same way that he can accept, I don't know if accept is the right word, but if as an adult he can look back and say that his mother is not defined by only her flaws, he can do that with Sloane. You know, there does come a point when we're young and things are happening to us and we're, you know, the gauzy veil is falling away and we're looking at our parents and saying, what is going on? Or adults or teachers or, you know, who disappoint us. At a certain point when we're adults and we're looking back on it and we're making our own mistakes, I think, we get it. We get it and we can tell the story and we might even be mystified by it and say, how could my mother have gotten into bed and puked on the pillow? I can't believe that happened. Like, that's so extreme. But in the story, he just goes on to the next thing because there's more to a life. There's more that's going to happen. There's more that has happened.
So and I think that's why Yeats is always so against the grain, you know? I think that is what defines him. And Yeats was my own teacher's teacher, Andre de Musses, who Andre loved him. He wrote a beautiful essay. It's about a page and a half long where he imagines Richard Yeates at his desk writing in the morning. I think of your mornings, Dick, is how it starts, I think. I just think that Yeats, you know, we don't spend a lot of time on biography in our talks because we're so focused on the stories because that's what we do, you know. But, you know, Yeats died broke in Boston in a tiny apartment, as far as I understand. I haven't read the biography of him. One day I hope to. I've heard it's good, even though the writer of the biography has had his share of knocks in recent years, which we maybe don't need to get into, but that shouldn't necessarily affect the biography of Yeats. I think Yeats is somebody who has this weird, despairing faith in his characters. And like almost despairing faith in his country, you know what I mean? There's something about him that almost refuses, in spite of all of the hypocrisies and the cruelties, he refuses to give up on everything. And you think he would, you know? Helen has her long, slow demise into alcoholism. That is in the story. It's going to happen. It's going to end badly. But again, I mean, maybe we're just hitting this point too hard, is it doesn't define her completely. What defines her completely or at least in part, is what she was there when the fish got killed. You know what I mean? And that I maybe I'm focusing on the more positive aspects of the story. I don't know why necessarily, but I feel like they compete with the darkness, which is very much here. I think that's a Yeatsian sort of weirdness that is worth celebrating.
But, oh my gosh, don't we understand it? We get it. We get it. And we get it. Yeah. And I don't know how he did it. I don't know how he did it, but we get it. And maybe we allow people who are listening, who haven't read the story, to read the story to see what happens. But I think it would be good to read the last part.
Sure. Bart, you know, as people do, Bart's been talking behind Helen's back, right? And he has apparently told a friend that he found this dumb, crazy rich woman to who's paying him to tutor her kids. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, again, like that anyone would say to someone else, not thinking it's ever going to get back to the person you're talking about, because maybe you don't really even mean it. That's how I see it. But Bart has said this, and it has gotten back to Helen. And Helen is pissed. And she confronts Bart, and she tells him off. "I want you to get out of my house, Bart," she said. "And I don't ever want to see you again. And I want to tell you something. All my life, I've hated people who say some of my best friends are Jews, because none of my friends are Jews or ever will be. Do you understand? None of my friends are Jews or ever will be." I laugh because it's not funny, but it's funny. And then what is the brilliance of the ending? I hope our listeners, our many legions of listeners, will forgive me for highlighting what happens at the end, but it is such a extraordinary, like, fictional move, is that Helen tells the story of her telling off Bart a couple hours later on the phone. And that is how the story ends. She was on the phone giving Sloane Cabot the highlights of the scene, and it was clear that Sloane would take her side and comfort her. Sloane might know how the Virgin Mary felt on the way to Bethlehem, but she also knew how to play my stutter for laughs. In a case like this, she would quickly see where her allegiance lay, and it wouldn't cost her much to drop Bart Camden from her enchanted circle. When the telephone call came to an end, at last there was silence downstairs until we heard her working with the ice pick in the ice box. She was making herself another drink. There would be no more school in our room. We would probably never see Bart again, or if we ever did, he would probably not want to see us. But our mother was ours, we were hers, and we lived with that knowledge as we lay listening for the faint, faint sounds of millions. I guess we should say that the final moment, listening for the faint sounds of millions, which doesn't really need an explanation, does refer back to an absolutely gorgeous moment earlier in the story where Edith, the sister, tells Billy that if he listens very carefully, he can hear all of the sounds that millions and millions of New Yorkers are making in the night, taking off their shoes before bed and the thump on the floor, you know, stirring tea, you know, the tiny, you know, gazillion sounds that would make up New York City. She's not talking about the sirens and the honking or, you know, the airplanes or sounds like that. She's talking about the little sounds that you don't hear. And she says, if you're quiet enough, Billy, you can hear those sounds. So that's how he puts himself to sleep at night. So, you know, the story's so beyond the story. And, you know, it's one of the truly great ones. And I'm glad we talked about it.
Richard Yates is the author of Oh, Joseph, I'm So Tired. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.